Hello, friends, and welcome once again to the Foundry Church podcast. My name is Joseph. I'm the worship pastor here at the Foundry Church in Winter Springs, Florida. And this week, I was also the preacher. Seth, our lead pastor, and Hunter Mertz, our family life pastor, were both out of the country on a trip to Nicaragua to visit one of our missions partners there. And so I got the opportunity to fill in and preach. It was week four of our current series called Party, where we've been taking a five-week-long look at the parable of the prodigal son. This week, I got to preach about the older son in the story, who is, I think, the often very overlooked character. And so it was kind of fun to dip into that a little bit until I actually dipped into it. And then it ended up being one of those sermons for me that was sort of convicting. Got my toes stepped on a little bit while I was preparing it, and I think there's a chance it was that kind of sermon for some people who heard it. Maybe it will be for you too, but don't let that stop you. It's important to do that in the life of a believer, to kind of challenge ourselves and hold up a mirror sometimes, even when what we see doesn't look like we thought it would look or doesn't look good. So with that being said, please enjoy this message. This is week four of our series, Party. Well, welcome to the Foundry Church, where we're all about a better you and a better world. Whether you're joining us online today or later on in the week, as we know is sometimes the case, or whether you're here with us in the room, we're so glad to see you. My name is Joseph. I'm the worship pastor here. Seth is part of that group, part of that mission team that's down in Nicaragua at Misión Para Cristo with our buddy Benny Baker. We're very excited to be hearing back from them. It looks like they might have enough internet to do updates on the Foundry Family Facebook group, so if you're part of that, you can check in on there. I saw an update yesterday that they had arrived safely, so that's like the first answered prayer is that they got out of here and got down there. Okay. It's been a while since we've done a trip like that as a church, so we're really excited. It's something we want to do a lot more of moving forward. We're in the middle of a series right now. This is actually week four of five in a series called Party, and we're taking a good long look at the parable. It's commonly called the parable of the prodigal son, or maybe the parable of the lost son, but as we've seen so far and will continue to see today, it just as easily could be called the parable of the dysfunctional family. There's kind of a lot going on, and it's not all on the younger son. Not much of it is all that great. Almost none of it is what would have been expected culturally, and the whole story would have been really shocking to the people that Jesus told the story to. So Seth, in the office as we're going through the year, we talk through sermon series and that kind of stuff, and he actually started off this whole series conversation in our office with a verse that we've shared a couple of times already. It's from Matthew 11. And verse 16 and 17, and this is Jesus speaking, and he says, "To what can I compare this generation? They are like children sitting in the marketplaces and calling out to others, 'We played the pipe for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, and you did not mourn.'" In the context of what Jesus is saying there, he's talking to a crowd of people in the middle of a conversation with this crowd of people. Some followers of John the Baptist come up to him, and they want to know, "Jesus, are you the one?" John wants to know, "Are you the one that we've been waiting for, that we've been talking about?" And Jesus answers them, go tell John, the blind see, the lame walk, all that stuff, kind of confirming that he is the one that John's been waiting for. And then there's this comment, which is almost an aside. It's almost like Jesus is talking to himself at this little introspective moment. And then he goes back to sort of talking about John and himself and the way that they're received by the people. But this two-verse little thing here got me thinking about, it rang a bell in my head, as is so often the case. We hear something and it makes us think about something else that's related. And there's this passage that the Apostle Paul wrote. It's in Romans 12. It kind of embodies the same sentiment. And right towards the beginning of it, in verse 3, he says, "For by the grace given to me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed to each of you. He goes on for a little while, and then in Romans 12:15, he writes, rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. That's really the one that was kind of tripped in my head with the whole thing about playing the flute and people not dancing, singing a dirge and people not mourning. Rejoice with those who rejoice, mourn with those who mourn. Don't think of yourselves more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment. Hold on to those two for later. We'll get there. 2 weeks ago, we focused on the younger son. Seth preached that one, and on how what the younger son did by asking his father for his inheritance early was not just a rash, impetuous, youthful mistake. It was an affront. It was an insult. It was a complete rejection of everything that his life was supposed to be and was supposed to be about. Let me share how I remember this story being talked about in my church and in my youth group growing up, and you tell me if this sounds familiar. Okay, so this is the parable of the prodigal son as it was explained to me growing up. There was a father who had two sons. The younger son didn't want to obey. He didn't want to follow rules. He wanted to live a wild, sinful life. And so he asked his father for his portion of the inheritance, and he went off to drink and party and do other sinful things. And while his sinful lifestyle caught up to him, and he hit rock bottom, realizing that his life was much better when he was obedient and faithful to his father, he repented and went home to try to work for his father, becoming the lowliest of his father's servants. And the father was so great in his love and in his grace that he ran out to meet his son, even though that wasn't what a dignified man of means should do. And even after all that this prodigal son had put him through, he accepted the prodigal son back into the family because of the son's repentance. Does that ring a bell? Is that maybe how you remember it being talked about in your church background, if you have a church background? What a beautiful story, right, of repentance and of the Father's grace. The Father in this story obviously represents God, who is gracious and loving and is always willing to welcome us back to the family when we repent and come home. And the prodigal in this story is obviously each one of us, right? It represents each of us lowly sinners who wander like sheep. We wander astray only to be welcomed back when we see the error of our ways. If you've been paying attention over the last couple of weeks, you know there are a few problems with that telling of the story. There's issues with misinterpretation of the language that Jesus uses around the younger son's behavior, right? Seth talked about he got into the weeds a little bit, but talking about how the language Jesus uses about the son's behavior doesn't necessarily have to mean sinful, immoral behavior. It could just be wasteful and not careful and that kind of thing. So there's that. There's cultural considerations that get left out. Both Hunter and Seth have spent a lot of time talking about just the expectations that Jesus' listeners would have had going into this story and how every part of this story goes contrary to those cultural expectations. And those things bear real weight on the story. But most importantly, and especially for the message today, that telling of the story of the prodigal son that I just kind of walked through completely leaves out the older son, the older brother. And that was something I didn't notice until much later. College, I think, was the first time I had a class where we talked about the older son. He's kind of the left out one. And we're going to get into that a little bit, too. So we've talked more in detail about the younger son and the father. We're focusing on the third of the three main characters in the story, the older son. And let me just tell you right from the start, it's not a better picture of togetherness and community than the last 2 weeks. It's just a different kind of bad. Let me tell you also that I love you, I'm with you, I'm one of you. We're all in this together today, but this might be a little bit of an uncomfortable message for some of us. I know that it was for me as I prepared this week. So, that said, let's walk through the story. We're gonna walk through it from the older brother's perspective and see if we can't see something that we haven't seen yet. So in Luke 15, we'll start with 11 through 16. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything." This is a quick aside for me. It's amazing how many times you can read the same thing and still find something new. That last phrase, "no one gave him anything," it just as I was reading it now hit me what a contrast that is to the father who gave him everything. Maybe that didn't mean anything to anybody but me, but that's okay. Okay, so there's a lot going on here that Seth and Hunter have already pointed out over the last 3 weeks. I'm not going to rehash all of it because I know you don't want to be here all day, and I don't either. But I'll sum it up to say that this was really shocking and terrible behavior on the part of the younger son. This was wishing his father's death, right? This everything we just read in these first few verses, it was either immoral living or extremely wasteful living or both. This was sinking to the absolute depths where he would not only hire himself out to a foreigner, but would work by feeding pigs, which if you know anything about kosher diet lifestyle, pigs are kind of a no-go. So he's hired himself out to a foreigner, he's working with pigs, and he even wants to eat what the pigs eat. This is a huge mess that is quite obviously entirely his fault, right? No one did anything except him to get himself to this point. It's all his doing. And we'll continue in verse 17. "When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So at rock bottom, this younger son remembers that he has a father who is wealthy enough to have given away a significant portion of his wealth to his younger son and still has enough to employ servants. Maybe this wealthy father will consent to give him a job. Being a servant to his wealthy father would definitely be a step up from working for a foreign pig farmer. This is his way out. This is his step up in the world. This is his salvation. This rash, impetuous, terrible behavior, younger son. Verse 20, we continue. "So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate, for this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate." So again, in the last two messages, Seth has talked quite a bit about how this really flies in the face of the cultural norms of that day and that location, that day and age. The father should have been absolutely enraged at the younger son for even asking for his inheritance early. He should have punished the son severely for ever bringing it up. He should have disowned him for showing such disrespect when he left. The community that they lived in should have also done the same. He should, by all rights, never have been allowed to come home. Never been welcomed in that community again. Yet here the father is, not only allowing him to return as a servant, not part of the family, but like not only welcoming his return, like, "I'm happy you're home," not only embarrassing himself by running out to meet the son, but then throwing the younger son a party, recognizing and reinstating him as his son, and restoring him to his previous position as if nothing had ever happened. This is to the people Jesus was speaking to, and hopefully to us, putting ourselves in their place a little bit. This is unbelievable. This is unbelievable behavior. Now, let's pause real quick for a moment and point out something that you might have noticed, but it's worth saying anyways. Other than there was a man who had two sons, who's missing from the story so far? The older brother, right? There's two sons. We've only talked about the bad one so far. There's no mention of the older brother in this entire story up to this point. Everything has been focused on the younger son and his escapades. The older brother must feel like such an also-ran, right? Such an afterthought. When I was in youth group growing up, I remember going to conferences and camps and stuff like that, and like sometimes it would happen in youth group on Sunday night or Wednesday night, where somebody would give their testimony, right? Or maybe there was a video they'd put together. We've done stuff like that. We put together a video of somebody sharing their story, and oftentimes it's like a really dramatic testimony about being in a bad situation or living a sinful lifestyle or just being very far from God and having an encounter with God's grace, having an encounter with Jesus, and now everything's different and better. It's not perfect, but it's better. Everything's different. My life has turned around. I'm following Jesus. It's all good. And I recall a moment, I think maybe it was at a church camp, and listening to one of these speakers and hearing like the applause and the cheering and like people are so excited about this person's testimony, their story of life change, and I'm just thinking, I don't have a testimony. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up in a healthy, happy home. I didn't have needs that weren't met. I didn't lack for love from my parents. I got a good education. I had lots of opportunity. I got to do a lot of very interesting and exciting and fun things that enriched my life. I grew up in a really good church. I had a great, like, spiritual experience. I wasn't going around partying. I wasn't, like, doing all sorts of crazy stuff. I wasn't a prodigal. And I remember having this moment of listening to another story of dramatic life change, and just people are so excited for this story. And I'm thinking, does my story matter? Like, does anyone care that I'm a good little youth group boy? Or do we only care about prodigals? Right? And if you can identify with that feeling, then you can identify with the older brother in this story. Luke 15:25. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." I mean, let's be real. Guy's got a point here, doesn't he? Like, how is it anything other than terribly unfair to the older brother? How is this, like, this whole sequence of events anything other than rewarding and enabling the younger son for his bad behavior? Shouldn't there be consequences for his bad behavior? Why should he, when he should be shunned and punished and cast back out of the community, why is he being celebrated? Right, from the older brother's perspective, this is awful. Let's finish it out, verse 31. "My son," the father said, "you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." Do you see the core issue that the older brother is dealing with here? It's hanging in space like a huge elephant in the room. The central issue that we've got to talk about with the older brother's story is it just isn't fair, is it? It's not fair what is happening in this story. It's like another parable that Jesus told. It's a longer one. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's from Matthew 20, verses 1 through 16. And the gist of it is this. There's a landowner who goes out. The workday in that age, I think, would have been something like, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., sun up to sunrise, whatever. And he goes out in the morning to hire people, day laborers, to work on his property. And they agree to work for the day for one denarius, which was like generally agreed to be one day's wage. Then around 9 a.m., around noon, and around 3 p.m., he goes back to get more workers to work the remainder of the day, and they all agree to work for one denarius. Then at 5 p.m., so like 1 hour before quitting time, this owner goes back to the marketplace, and he finds people who are just still standing around, and he says, "Why aren't you working?" And they say, "Well, nobody hired us." And he goes, "I'll hire you. Come work the rest of the day for me. I'll pay you a denarius." So at the end of the day, he calls all the workers, and he calls his foreman, and he says, "Pay the people what they agreed to be paid. Start with the 5 p.m. crew." And so the 5 p.m. crew, these people who worked 1 hour, get their denarius. The 6 a.m. crew sees this and goes, "Whoa, I know we agreed to work the whole day for a denarius, but these guys got a denarius for 1 hour. We'll probably get more." And then when it gets to them and they get their one denarius, they're upset. Maybe understandably so, but they're upset. And the landowner tells them, "Hey, I'm not being unfair. You agreed to work for one denarius. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you jealous that I'm being generous? Are you envious that I'm being generous with these people?" And I think this story illustrates pretty clearly the mentality of the older son, right? He was the one who had been through it with the father. He had stayed. He had worked. He had labored. He had been faithful. He had done his duty. He had obeyed. He had submitted. He had subordinated himself to the father. And here's this younger son getting rewarded as if he had done all those things too. It's not fair. Which also begs the question, what is fair? What is fairness? What are we talking about when we say something is fair or not fair? I sometimes joke, we have a couple of songs in our worship team repertoire, and I occasionally make the joke about how, words have a lot of different definitions in the dictionary, and sometimes we use a word and we're using the third or fourth definition. We have two songs that came to mind. We have one song called Furious and another one called Fierce. All right, and these are actually songs about God's love, right? Not about God's anger. We're just using the third or fourth or fifth definition of those two words. Fair, as it turns out, is a word with 10 different definitions and connotations in most dictionaries. We use it in a lot of different ways. But for the sake of this conversation, I'm pretty sure we're talking about one that's right near the top, and it's this: being in agreement or harmony with merit or importance. That's a fancy dictionary way to say, if I deserve this and I get this, that's not fair. We would be less inclined to say, if I deserve this and I get this, that's not fair. That's okay as long as it works in our favor, right? But by that definition, for something to be fair, it has to be in agreement, it has to fit with our perceived notion of how meritorious or important we are. You see that? If I think I deserve this, but I get this, that's not fair. But what if I actually deserve this? What if I have a wrong impression of what I deserve? That's the problem with fair. It's a moving target for each of us based on how we view ourselves. Some of us think we deserve this, but we actually deserve this. It's really hard to see ourselves clearly. When someone gets a promotion at work and we think, man, I do my job better than that person. Why didn't I get that promotion? That's not fair. When someone gets praise for their work and we don't, that's not fair. When someone receives a benefit that we didn't receive, that's not fair. Why should someone else get something that I didn't? That's not fair. Watch your toes. I promise I'm not just trying to step on your toes. I told you, I'm here with you, I'm one of you, I love you, but we have to talk through this. Underneath all these sorts of questions about fairness, there's this unspoken statement that is a little difficult to acknowledge and to confront. And that statement is, they don't deserve more than me. And if you're like me, when you confront that unspoken statement and you acknowledge it, it's a bit uncomfortable. It doesn't feel good to acknowledge that we feel a sense of superiority towards someone else. It doesn't even feel good to realize and acknowledge that, like, somewhere deep down, there's still maybe an us and them type of mentality. They don't deserve more than me. She doesn't deserve more than me. It's not fair. So what's the antidote to this? How do we break ourselves of this kind of us and them thinking? How do we break ourselves of this need to compare ourselves and our blessings with those of other people? This is something we really have to grapple with as believers. Because again, we're talking about important stuff here. And the reality is that although we like to point to the amazing life change and the repentance of the younger son, and we like to point to the grace shown by the father in the story, we like to talk about that. The reality is that most of us, most of the time, we're probably the older brother in this story. Now, I told you at the beginning there were those two verses from Romans 12 we're going to come back to. Romans 12:3, do not think of yourself... Nope, I did the wrong one. Oh yeah, the part of it, sorry. Do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment. I think Paul wrote sober judgment here because he realized that it is human nature to inflate ourselves in our own minds somewhat. It is very hard to see ourselves as we truly are, to see ourselves clearly. I think that might even be harder than seeing ourselves as God sees us, which is also something we aspire to. The even greater thing that's at play here is what Paul wrote down in Romans 12:15. Rejoice with those who rejoice and mourn with those who mourn. The cold, hard truth of the older son in this story is this. He felt aggrieved because he had been faithful and loyal and obedient and hardworking for the father, and his younger brother, who had done none of those things, was being showered with affection and luxury. But as Seth and Hunter pointed out in previous sermons, the older son wasn't as perfect as he thought he was. He maybe was thinking of himself more highly than he ought to. Culturally, I think Hunter talked about this in the first week, his job as the firstborn son would have been to sort of step in and help mediate disputes between the father and the younger son. But as we pointed out, in that section of the story where the younger son is asking for his inheritance and then is shipping off to a country far away, older brother's absent. He's not doing what he should have been doing. He should have stepped in at the very beginning. He's not there. When the younger son returns, the father obviously sees it as a joyous occasion, right? Bring out the robe, bring out the ring, let's kill the fattened calf, let's have a feast. But he does not send someone to the field to notify his older son. His younger son comes home, was dead and now is alive, was lost, now is found, and the father doesn't tell the older son. I think it seems probable that this is like at least the father knew that the older son would still be holding a grudge and would be displeased at this news, would be displeased that the younger son had returned, would be displeased that the father had accepted him back into the family. How would the father know that the older son would be holding a grudge if the older son hadn't spent the time between his brother leaving and his brother returning complaining, holding a grudge, grumbling? So the older brother clearly didn't spend much, if any, time mourning with his father when the younger son went away. He didn't grieve with his father when his father lost a son earlier in the story, and he clearly has no plans to rejoice with the father's rejoicing at the younger son's return. Seth also pointed out, I think last week, that in the older son's speech to his father when he's justifying his anger, he mentioned how the father never even gave him a goat to celebrate with his friends, which would to some extent be seen in the same light as the younger son asking for his inheritance. And so he casts himself in the light, the older brother does, of this loyal, obedient son, and yet culturally, a son with a normal relationship with his family would have immediately gone into the party and joined in the celebration. Older, like firstborn sons in that context had responsibilities at a party like that, and he held himself apart from it. The older son in the story is suspicious. He's asking questions. He refuses to go in out of anger when he hears this incredible news. His attitude is 100%, I have worked, where is mine? Give me mine. This other son of yours has not worked, and yet you honor him and celebrate him. The older son thinks of himself more highly than he ought to, and it prevents him from rejoicing with those who rejoice, just as it prevented him from mourning with those who mourned when his brother left home. How often do you think we are the older son, and we don't even realize it? How often do we allow this us and them mentality to infect our thinking and cause us to view ourselves more highly than we ought to? How often do we genuinely believe that we are the hero of the story when all along we're just as screwed up as everybody else? How often do we fail to rejoice with those who rejoice? How often do we fail to mourn with those who mourn? How often do we do these things and we don't even realize that we're doing them? One of the very important Bible verses saying of Jesus in my life, and I, you know, it's part of our culture here at the church. We talk about God's intended reality. It's another way of saying life to the full, right? So John 10:10 says, Jesus says, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. The younger son tried, right? He went out looking for life in the fast lane, partying, wild living, or as Seth pointed out, maybe it was just wasteful living. Maybe the younger son was blowing through all this inheritance money, trying to curry favor and win friends and make people like him. Maybe he was just being lavish and generous with his money. But either way, he took his father's money. He ran off away from his family and his friends and his community, and he had all the trappings of a full life for a while. But it was missing the depth and the richness of it. You can't buy happiness. You can't buy friends. You can't buy peace. It takes a long time to become old friends. And old friends and deep family connections, an intertwined community, these are the things that help us get through the hard times in life. The younger son was missing the point. He thought he could get life to the full through only experiencing the good times, the ups. But this type of disconnected and unbalanced and wasteful living, it's empty. It's unsustainable. It's missing the depth and the complexity and the difficulty and the shared experience that makes life worthwhile. We sang a dirge, but you did not mourn. The older son, we could say, if we're being very charitable to the older son, that he was living with a work hard now so you can play hard later kind of mentality. He thought if he worked hard and paid his dues and towed the company line, that he would be rewarded. Certainly he would be rewarded more than his wayward younger brother. He was thinking too highly of himself and his motivations and his actions. He was missing the joy in life. The older son, too, was missing the point. He thought that life to the full meant working hard so he could retire wealthy. But steadfast obedience, slaving away, as he said to his father, without enjoying life, it's just as empty as what the younger son was doing. We played the pipe for you, but you didn't dance. The party is the kingdom of God. You probably already guessed that. You probably already figured that out, but I'll say it anyways. It's the metaphor we're using, you know, for this series. I think it's pretty clearly the metaphor that Jesus is using in this parable, right? There's a huge feast. All are invited. The older son's us and them mentality, his belief that he deserved more than he got, and that the younger son deserved less than he got, and his continued broken relationship with the father. It all led to this story, this parable that Jesus told, ending with him standing on the outside. And in the end, the older son chose not to go in and join the party. He chose to stand outside all alone in the dark and hold on to his bitterness, his angerness, and his self-righteousness. Actually, that's not entirely true. When he finds out that when the older brother finds out that he has come home and that the party is in his honor, right, he gets angry and he refuses to go in. The father comes out and pleads with him to come inside. And the parable actually ends with a cliffhanger. Have you noticed this as we've read through it these last few weeks? Jesus never really indicates whether or not the father's pleading makes any impact on the son. Jesus doesn't say if the father's pleading convinces the older son to go in and join the party or not. It's open-ended. It's as if Jesus was saying to his listeners and also to us, the party is here. The party is now. The party is all around you. You're invited. Will you enter? Can you bring yourself to enter if he is also there? If she is there? Can you bring yourself to enter the kingdom of heaven if they are also allowed in? Whoever they is for you. Can you bring yourself to enter into the kingdom where all are invited and all are welcome? You are all invited and you are all welcome if you will allow yourself to be.
And that's it. I hope, again, that the message didn't come across as too heavy-handed. But again, I do believe it's important for us as believers, or as even people who are interested in faith, maybe not a believer in Jesus yet. It's important for people to take stock and take inventory and be honest with ourselves. And I know that just about every time in my life when I have gotten on my high horse, when I've been a little self-righteous, when I've been so confident that I was doing everything right and, you know, was certainly doing everything better than this other person, there was always a moment that was very humbling shortly after that. Pride goes before the fall, as they say, as the book of Proverbs says. I think that's Proverbs. It might be Ecclesiastes. Anyways, I'm rambling. That's going to do it for now for this episode of the Foundry Church Podcast. We'll see you next time. Have a great week.